8:11 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Board of Education met yesterday in a work session. Two big topics came before them, open enrollment and then the design groups for the program and design of the new school facilities. In the studio with details, I have school board members Julie Eihausen and Phil Kaplan. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So first, the board spent some time talking about open enrollment. So going forward, this is going to be a significant concern for the board, given that as we create more capacity in the schools, how do we justify to our voters that we're not just going to fill it with out-of-state or out-of-boundary students?
Well, we're not necessarily creating additional capacity. Well, I shouldn't say that. We are creating capacity, but it's for the students that we have, that we currently have enrolled in our district. We did get a question yesterday at one of our presentations about the building for the 5-6, you know, that we're building it just so we can fill it again with out of district students, and that is not our interest. We plan on that facility being pretty much at capacity once it's built.
Yeah.
I'll just make a general comment about open enrollment, which is that open enrollment is Utah state law. It's not a Park City specific issue. And basically what it says is that to the extent that we have capacity under certain class size and district and state formulas, we have to take out-of-district kids. And what I will say is at this point, an open enrollment is 3% of our student population, of which a very large percentage is district employees' children, which we do allow as a policy.
Yeah, well, it seemed that you had some questions, and we didn't really know how many are coming from, are considered employee students.
Correct. We are waiting for that updated report. So as of this point, we do know that we have 149 out of roughly 5,000 total children that are open enrollment. So 3%, that number we know for sure. What the board asked the superintendent and business manager to find out is exactly how many of the 149 are district. We know that 21 of those kids were renewed district employee kids, but it's certainly going to be a lot more than 21.
Yeah. So is that considered a benefit of employment with the Park City School District?
Yes.
Yeah, we want to attract the best and the brightest teachers to teach the children in the district. So if the teacher does not happen to live in Park City and they have children that are in the K-12 or pre-K-12 range, we would like to facilitate their being able to be employees of our district.
Yeah. And so really, basically what the state law means is that if there is a classroom, that classrooms are not assigned to teachers. Classrooms are assigned to the school. So it means that if a teacher teaches 5 out of the 7 periods of a day, that means that there are 2 periods that that classroom is free and then to be filled up with other students.
They calculate based on the square footage. So it's if an area can be used as a classroom, they count it as a classroom. But the calculations to determine whether or not you have room are very detailed. So, you know, you can go through one exercise and maybe it points towards a school being closed or a school being opened, but then you can go into a deeper calculation depending on what your class sizes are in that building. It's just very complicated. And that is actually a reason that we are going to be reviewing that policy so we are completely clear on exactly what we need to do to comply with the statute and the law from the state of Utah, but also to make sure we understand exactly how everything is calculated and what all of the steps are. So we will be reviewing that policy. It's on our list.
Mm-hmm. So like with PC CAPSO, I mean, we put those classes now in the library. Couldn't we have just assigned classroom space for that? And then that fills the school up?
The high school is at capacity. Mm-hmm. The high school is actually at 102%. So the high school is above capacity.
Yeah, I'm going to get back to PC CAPSO.
Okay.
But Todd Hauber reported that 15 students are in the district from Promontory, which is really part of South Summit School District. Word on the street, and apparently in realtors' offices, is that if you live in Promontory, if you just make a big enough donation to the Park City Education Foundation, that you get your kid into the district.
I do not know where that came from. That and maybe that's a rumor. That's been like an urban legend or a rumor for years since I have lived here from 2002. We are partners with the Ed Foundation, but I've said this before, the Park City School District is not for sale.
Have we said no to any Promontory students?
I don't have specific data on exactly which kids we said no to. I believe we had something like 200 applications for the 149 that we let in, and I don't know which of the 51 that were turned down due to our being at capacity at 5 of 7 schools were related to Promontory versus other places.
Yeah, but would you take them from Promontory first, given that you're going to get more money into the district because of the higher valued home?
Yeah, you know, we have not set clear policy on that at this point, and that is at this point we're in a there's an annual requirement for the district to give reporting to the board about open enrollment status. So as we get that data, and as we get, we sent the superintendent and business manager back with a number of questions that the board had. So we need to first get the data, and then we can act on the data and set policy that makes sense. Certainly, makes logical sense. The most open enrollment impact that we have is from from Wasatch School District, from South Summit School District, and from North Summit School Districts. And there's also flow going the other direction. So there are kids that live within our boundaries that are going to those districts. So we are getting clear data on what the actual facts on the ground are across all those spaces, how many of those are district employees' children, and then we can act accordingly, and also knowing what construction projects are out there. So until we have all the facts, we're not going to have a policy discussion.
October 1st, that is the final deadline for enrollment to the state of Utah. Where are we with in terms of what was budgeted for? Did you get those numbers from Todd?
We did not get the count. We did not get the count yesterday.
Okay. Let's talk about design teams. I mean, how many teams do we have, and who's involved?
Oh, boy. I think we have 6 or 7. I can go through them. We have an Ecker design team for the 5-8 campus. We have the athletic facility design team. We have the high school design team, which actually is going to end up breaking up into 2 subgroups because we've got the performing arts area, and then we've got the academic wing, and those are kind of 2 different ducks. We've got the McPolin design team. We've got a start times committee, and we've got a school boundaries committee, which actually affects the elementary. So I guess that's 6.
All right. Well, let's talk about the timeline here, and this would have to do with those committees that are designing new facilities. If the bond is approved, you have, 7 months then before the opening of school 2016? What has to be done for that to happen?
Okay, so I'm going to just start with the phrase of if the bond is approved, because these projects are moving forward. They have to move forward. They are a necessity. I've been using the example of it's not like we're asking if the public wants us to buy more open space or if we want to add additional hiking trails. These are facilities that we absolutely need. So the design teams have been formed. They will be moving forward. The timeline, and that was something that the administrators really spoke to yesterday, we need to move backwards from 2017. So fall of 2017, if we're going to have the facilities done, what deadlines do we need to start meeting? And 7 months of planning seems like we should be able to be prepared to start construction in spring of 2016.
Yeah, and then I'll just add that it's in order of the priority that is on the bond proposition. So the top priority is Park City High School, which Julie already mentioned is 102% of capacity, and that's before we roll the 9th grade in. So we really need to get started. We anticipate roughly a 2-year kind of time frame for getting that completed.
If the bond doesn't pass, you're going to move forward with the projects anyway, but don't you have to wait a year, or you just start with that $20 million that you have in the capital fund?
We will have to, the main priorities are, just as Phil said, the high school and the 5-6 school. The rest of the items, we would have to probably refigure or reconfigure the timeline for those, because we cannot enter into debt unless we have authority to bond. So our option would be to spend the 20 million that we've got, or spend a portion of that, and then wait for the levy money to come in to move any more.
Yeah, that levy money doesn't come in though until, because you have to have a board, you'd have to have a truth and taxation hearing next June,
absolutely,
next August. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to even get that money until a year from December, right?
Yep. Yeah, so
I'll just say, I mean, there's a reason that governmental agencies, there's actually a lot of reason that governmental agencies that are contemplating construction do it via bonding. And look, for one, it's the least tax impacting way to finance construction. And we have near historical low interest rates right now. So that is why the only proposition that is being considered at this point is going to a 20-year type bond structure to finance the necessary school construction.
Well, let's do the numbers then. And I'm going to say right off the top that both of you guys are better at numbers than I am. So please correct me. But the annual interest on $56 million at 4% interest is more than $2 million a year. Multiply that by 20 years, and we're talking at interest alone at $40-plus million for a $56 million bond. Am I in the ballpark?
It's essentially P&I payments, right? So, you know, that's one way to look at it. But the reality is you're paying principal off during the period. So it ends up being significantly less than that. It also depends when you issue it. So, I mean, the way that we stated it, it's roughly a $4 million annual payment if you do the P&I amortization over that period. So in a sense, the aggregate of the payments over 20 years is, you know, roughly $80 million. And that is principal and interest, and that is not present value. So the $56 million is present value money, and now you're talking about $80 million spread out over 20 years, so you figure the average payment is 10 years in the future, so you discount that back to present if you want to do sort of simple math on it, but it's...
About $24 million that we'll be paying in interest then over the life of the bond.
Correct.
Yeah. So wouldn't it just be cheaper then to do it with the... you know, the annual tax levy that we pay? It's just too much for the average family to pay?
Yeah, I mean, again, just look at the financial calculation is really present value. That's your apples to apples comparison. So you're just going to have a lot, you know, it's just going to be a much bigger bill. Yes, you will pay it off sooner, but it's going to be a much bigger bill. And then the other risk that we would incur that we don't incur with the bond is that because construction costs have been escalating something like 10 to 15% per year, if it takes us a number of years more, we're actually risking construction cost escalation that is more expensive, frankly, than the interest that is paid way in the future. So it just seemed, you know, there's a reason that we did it the way that we did it.
Yeah, still, but we'd have that $24 million to play with. Because if you do pay it year by year,
but we could,
is no interest payment.
But we would most likely, if I would say it's almost a certainty, that we would be paying significantly more for the facilities, and that $24 million would be eaten up. Also, we would be delayed in our construction. We would have more kids in trailers for a longer period of time. And... Go ahead.
All right.
So you put $100 in the bank at 4%. Next year, you have $404. The following year, you have $108.40. The year after that, it's you know, $112 and, you know, 88 cents approximately. It just compounds in the future, right? So it's the same thing when you're talking about making payments. So that $24 million that you're talking about doesn't really exist. It's basically the interest you're paying for the privilege of using the money today for construction, but it's not like you're really saving that money if you tax it at a much higher kind of a tax rate. That it doesn't really exist. It's not real savings. You have to look at the present value of the money. Anyway, it's a financial calculation. I hope I'm being clear in explaining it, but bonding is a much more efficient way from a spending perspective to do it.
All right. Well, you keep talking about the tight timeline, and you heard from the principals, your administrators expressing anxiety over it. I mean, how principals, like many residents, are feeling like this is just happening too fast. Why not stay in place? Give the principals time to plan when they already have a full-time job. You know, teaching children in trailers is a first-world problem.
Okay, so the anxiety or the conversation about this timeline, the principals were more concerned with the programming. There was some concern that the design teams were going to be heavily involved in defining the programming in the building. So we needed to clarify that that is really the job of the professionals that have that job. And that answer, from what I saw from the administrators, relieved quite a bit of anxiety. Because they want to make sure that there's not going to be arguing back and forth about what programming is going to go in there. They want to go with best practices, and the board definitely supports that. So the concerns about the timeline were, again, more about the programming and who was going to have the final say on what programming was happening in a building.
I guess I thought I heard from Tracy Evans that she was just, I have a full-time job. When am I gonna plan for the programming?
She did say that she has a full-time job, but that's because she wants to be able to just do her job, determine the programming for the building, and not have to go through a whole committee process to determine that.
Yeah. And my sense from the principals was there was pretty much, as we were discussing the process, which is essentially determine programming, determine building design according to programming needs and a future vision, and then go to detailed architectural type drawings based on that conceptual concept that's coming out of the design teams. And the principals seemed to breathe a collective sigh of relief when it was made clear to them that yes, you get to figure out, you know, the education experts get to figure out programming and bring that to the design team that includes a board member, that includes parents, that may include children and in certain, you know, students in certain circumstances and administrators and teachers.
Fifth and sixth grade school, have we decided if it's going to be one building with one principal and save money on the support staff for two schools?
That will be an administrative decision, so that is something that is under Dr. Conley's purview, not the school board's.
So when does that decision get made? Before we vote on a bond?
You'd have to ask Dr. Conley that.
I mean, I guess we've heard, you know, from before, it's like, well, we don't want the two schools, but now we're talking about having two schools, you know, and that they need a separate principal, an assistant principal, and secretaries for each school.
I don't know that has necessarily been determined. One of the things about the 5-8 campus and attaching the 5-6 to the existing Ecker is we do want to have the conversation about sharing facilities and about sharing resources. So that is something actually Phil is on the 5-8 design team. That is something that the design team will be talking about. Is there a possibility of consolidating the resources?
Yeah, I mean, look, our Park City Board of Education mission includes being fiscally responsible. So we will be having every one of those conversations. Can we share a kitchen? Can we share a gymnasium? Can we share performing arts spaces? Can we share front desks and administrative? And so we're going to have every single discussion, and everywhere where there's efficiencies from having a larger building, from sharing heating and cooling, that kind of thing, we're going to do it. And everywhere where it does not make sense for the children, we'll obviously, or from capacity perspective, we will have to build.
All right. Georgia Field, does it get moved or not? We still seem to hear board members talk about the possibility of Dozier Field not getting moved.
I have not heard a board member talk about that.
It's getting moved.
It's getting moved.
Yeah.
It's going east.
Okay. But I mean, even as early as yesterday, I mean, where you had to mouth to the reporter, you know, it's getting moved. You know, there was some discussion that it may not be getting moved. I mean, we have an athletic director who's saying maybe it doesn't get moved.
He is saying that because the official decision has not been made by the design team or by the school board. We haven't actually voted on moving it. The rationale for moving it is very strong, because we do need to be looking at what is the least impact of the construction on our students, what provides the best opportunity for future expansion, what makes the most sense for athletic consolidation, to have the support facilities for all of our athletic issues in one place. It just, I guess maybe we need to have a vote on that, but pretty much Dozier Field is moving.
So we know that when we vote November 3rd.
Yes.
And real quick, I'm going to be talking to a group here at 845. They've named themselves Citizens for Better Education. They have their reasons now for why people should not vote on the boat. Will the school district now allow their arguments to be posted on the website as they are with the for bond arguments?
So technically, the only things that we can publish on the website are the formal documents that the board has adopted around. So the argument for was a official document that we had to submit, but we are not, as a district, district employees on district equipment or as board members, able to advocate yes or no at this point. We obviously, prior to putting the proposition on the ballot, we had quite a bit of discussion, and obviously we elected to put the proposition on the ballot. But at this point, we are in the role of providing information only. There is a separate yes campaign, and apparently there's a separate no campaign, and the voters, you know, what we encourage everybody to do is to go out and vote. And early voting starts very soon, next week, I believe, or
week of the 19th.
Week of the 19th. And November 3rd is the official voting day. So, you know, please get out to vote. There's some very interesting other things to vote on, too. And certainly the bond has gotten a lot of attention.
I'm just saying that you've got it on the front page now in terms of why people should vote for the bond. Isn't it fair to add?
That's a requirement. That is a legal requirement that we have to put the reasoning for the bond going on the ballot. That is not the yes campaign's information or propaganda. It's not the no campaign. That is what is required by the state of the school board.
Oh, I was going to try and pull it up here really quick because it's, you know, right there. But it says something like, you know, for the bond.
That is our requirement to get the bond proposition on the ballot. There are still, again, there's two different groups. There's a yes group and there's a no group. And we are not advertising anything that the yes group is promoting or anything that the no group is promoting, because we are legally bound to not advocate one way or another.
But I'm just saying, you've already got bond argument for, why not bond argument against? That's all I'm asking.
That is the legal requirement. We don't have the yes campaign's information there. That is what we are required to post by the state. So it's not an advocating statement. It's an informational statement of the rationale for why the board put the bond on the ballot.
Okay, we're going to leave it at that. I'm out of time, but Julie and Phil, thanks for your time. It's 8:34 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Council meeting and work session Thursday starting at 3 o'clock in the studio with some of the details on the agenda. I have City Manager Diane Foster along with Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So first up, the Alice Claim subdivision. There's a site visit, a work session. My understanding, the applicant is back with an amended site plan now called the Gully Plan. So why isn't this coming back to Planning Commission? Why is it going to Council?
Well, this is the culmination of a long process over 10 years, and discussion is probably too gentle of a word, and conflict is probably too rough of a word, but 10 years of intense effort on the part of the Planning Commission and the applicant to try and bring development to that piece of ground, which is an old mine claim. And I also need to recognize 10 years of effort on the folks in the neighborhood trying to make sure the right thing is done and the rules are applied fairly. So this one is a policy decision. The City Council has the role to make that policy decision whether this goes forward or not.
To decide whether or not to accept the amended site plan?
They can choose to do it themselves. They can choose to remand it back to the Planning Commission.
All right. The appeal on the denial of the conditional use permit for the retaining walls that were taller than 6 feet, this actually still remains before the Council?
That's correct. That'll be on hold until they make a decision on the subdivision.
Yeah. Does the Gully Plan eliminate the need for retaining walls?
No. The wall stays almost exactly the same.
All right. And I noticed that there was some talk about basically the applicant, it's not that he can't get access. This is the only way, and that he has to have these 6-foot retaining walls. It's just that he hasn't received permission to do another plan.
This is one of the old long stories going on up there. There's some mine claims up there, and there's some old historic platted city streets, and there's a current road that goes up to the water tank. There's some access rights and the property owner still owns most of the rights to that current access road. So if he cannot acquire the rights to access via the current road, then he has to build the retaining walls and a new road.
All right. So does the gully plan work for the planning staff?
The gully plan is a lot like the plan that was presented in 2009. It's much more consistent with our current planning regulations and with the general plan and with the code that he originally applied for under. So part of his plan is regulated by the old zoning regulations. It's not perfect. We haven't had a chance to vet it. Engineering hasn't vetted it yet, but I think the concept is good enough to go to the city council and say, do you want to consider this?
So we're talking still 9 lots on about 9 acres?
9 lots on about 9 acres.
And so by bringing the houses off of the hillsides into the gully,
right?
Are they then now smaller? And
the lots are smaller. The home sizes are smaller. One driveway, which was in effect a private road, is eliminated. They're much closer to the bottom of the gully and the road. So most of the main neighborhood impacts are eliminated, or
right,
at least reduced.
Are they now in a floodplain?
That's one of the things we're going to study before we sign off on the plat.
Right.
And, you know, we have a number of homes in the floodplain, and a lot of the regulation of that is there's no living space at flood elevation. So he could build garages in the floodplain and live above it.
All right. But, again, it warrants, you think, from the planning staff, another look?
It warrants a look by the policymakers to tell us whether to go ahead or not.
And it is a hard question for City Council. They have a great deal of respect for their hand-selected planning commission, right? That they respect their role. The mayor was former chair of the planning commission and was on it for a number of years. And so it's a difficult question for them whether or not to remand it, because they very much believe in that process. That being said, ultimately in this case, the City Council is the decision-making body, and they hold that authority. So it is appropriate for them to be able to consider something de novo.
All right. At 5:50, a short update on the Mountain Accord, Wasatch Mountain land designation discussion. Is this scheduled for a future vote? I didn't see it on the agenda, but just an update? Or
It's an update. The Mountain Accord is asking for input from the various member communities about what type of designation should some of the land on the other side of the Wasatch, actually outside of Park City boundaries, some of it in Summit County, be given. And that has to do with what types of protections it would have. Some of the designations are old designations or designations that exist around certain types of conservation. And other designations are new types of designations. Ultimately, the City Council, when it has come to Mountain Accord, has very much wanted other communities to respect their ability to regulate land use within their own community. So staff is actually recommending on this one that City Council not provide an opinion, because there are no lands under consideration that are within the Park City limits.
Hmm. In terms of the federal designation that they're looking after, does the council have a consensus on that?
That's the question. But none of the land for that federal designation is within the Park City boundaries.
Okay. Let's see. In terms of, I was talking with County Manager Tom Fisher yesterday about the coordinated effort with regard to the study that Mountain Accord will do on Interstate 80. Things moving along there?
Things are moving along quite well. As you heard County Manager Tom Fisher say yesterday, Alfred Knotts, who's the Transportation Planning Manager for the city, and Caroline Ferris, who holds the corresponding role at the county, are working quite well together. They're both very experienced transportation experts, and they're coordinating on this. Caroline, on this piece, is taking the lead, although Alfred has quite a bit of knowledge and experience that he's brought to the table on the various alternatives analysis processes that are required.
So are city taxpayers only on the hook then for staff time? The actual study is all going to be paid for by Mountain Accord? Or,
so
well,
study,
it's also tax dollars.
The study will be paid for by Mountain Accord, and as you know, the city signed up and has contributed to the next phase, but there is staff time. But we are, you know, as in both the city and the county, we are being very careful about the amount of staff time spent on this, simply because while the I-80 corridor is a very important corridor for us, it's not the one that's congested.
All right. After two residents filed a formal noise complaint about the early trucks on Sweet Alley and Main Street, you have basically an update for looking into that?
We do. And actually, the police and the city attorney's office and our code enforcement were all working with these individuals before they came to city council to complain. And they were just not happy with the answer. So staff is providing city council with an update on all the city's efforts to date. And that includes working with the trucking companies on what types of braking are they using, not using their backup signals in the early morning hours. And honestly, the city had, we had a problem. That ordinance had changed, I believe, in 2011. And we had not updated the signs that are in the area, kind of right around the studio here. So deliveries starting at 3 a.m. are allowed, and the sign said 7 a.m., so that was causing some confusion for the residents as well. City staff continues to work with them, and we're staff is proposing that on the 22nd, we bring council some updates to the noise ordinance, and council can consider changing the time. That's not a staff recommendation at this point. However, we are recommending just some cleanup language to that ordinance.
So in terms of the noise complaint filed by the residents, is it because it's too loud? Or, I mean, was their complaint based on it was too early?
I believe it was a combination of both, that you know, the trucks pull into Sweet Alley at 3 or 4 in the morning and are parking, and it's a challenge of living in the Main Street core. City staff does their best to try to mitigate the impacts, but those are two coexisting uses that do exist in Main Street core.
All right. Let's see. Also, you'll have a response to Tim Henney's request regarding the residency characteristics of Park City's workforce. You went out and found out where the workforce is living?
We do. And this was for specifically Park City Municipal. And this is, I think, one of the things that came out of city tour to Breckenridge is knowing what percent of the workforce is able to live in the community. And I think that in addition to the already critical priority, that puts some additional fuel on the fire. And so of the city's full-time residents, of the city's full-time employees, only 20% of them live within the Park City limits. And if you look at the ones who do live in the Park City limits, there are 48 who live with either 84060 or 84068. 12 of those live in affordable housing, and an additional 6 live in apartments. And most of those who have come to work for the city recently have either live in affordable housing within city limits or haven't been able to purchase within the city, even if they wanted to. So that was some good data. We do have 25% of our workforce comes out of Wasatch County, 26% comes out of the Salt Lake and Davis County areas, and those for full-time employees. We also have statistics in there on part-time employees.
Yeah, I was going to say the 84068 is not a living area. It's just a post office box designation.
Correct. But we do, most of the folks who live in there who use that as a post office do live in the city.
All right. So what do you do with the findings?
It's information to, you know, one of the questions is that should we be, in all the city affordable projects, there are typically one or two units get to be, you know, out of the Snow Creek 13, I believe two of them were designated for city staff. That's a question for city council of, do we need to do more for the city's employees? There are benefits, you know, there are some folks who just aren't, you know, maybe grew up in Camas and work for the water department and they have a small ranch there and they're going to want to stay there. But there are a number of city employees who would want to live within city limits, and there are significant advantages from number one, response time, and number two, in an emergency, having people who physically live here, as well as in things like snow emergencies. A lot of times you'll see city, while we may offer in a snow emergency for people to go home early, you'll see a lot of people who live in city limits say, hey, it's okay, why don't you go? I'll stay and cover the window type of thing.
Yeah. So when you hear comments from council candidates about maybe raising some of our affordable housing and starting over and building more density, I mean, is that, you don't even have a say in that, do you?
The city council definitely has a say in tearing down affordable housing, especially
unless,
if they go deed restriction.
You'd have to have an application, though, right, from the property owner?
Sure, would have to do that. But city council is considering some denser housing in the area of Woodside. So, you know, increasing, we've heard very clearly from city council that they want this community to be economically diverse and to be able to have single individuals, families, people who work here. They want them to be able to live here. We want a vibrant community. It's part of who we are. And so they are looking at more dense
If you tear down affordable housing, though, to build more of it, I mean, how do you place the folks who are living there?
Yeah, I don't. That's not something that the city's considering doing right now as the city. So that would have to be something that someone would bring to city council. The city council right now is very much focused on new construction, both the 1454 and rehabs. Of course, the 1450, 1460 project is moving along, and we'll see the designs for that at the end of the month. And this time next year, people will be moving into those new affordable units. They've given staff direction to move forward on the idea of residential on the city property on Woodside. We just acquired the Ted Summers parcel, and we're trying to figure out if we can do some affordable units on the lower part of that property. So we are very focused on the getting new units and making it happen as quickly as possible.
All right. Anything else, Bruce? Diane?
No, thank you.
No, thank you.
All right. Thanks for your time. KBCW News Time now, 8:48. Good morning. Well, the first group organized to defeat the $56 million school bond has emerged. The group has named itself Citizens for Better Education. Two of those who say they do support education but not spending millions of dollars for what they believe are non-essential wants are Jim Tedford and Ali Zeisler. They join me now in the studio. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So with a name like Citizens for Better Education, it makes it sound like you're going to be voting for the bond, but both of you are against it. How come?
Well, I, as a former school teacher, am very concerned about education, as we all are in the group. And we didn't want to get the impression out there that we're against everything. We're actually for good education. And we just feel that, as you stated, there are too many excesses here to benefit the kids.
And Ellie, for you?
Yeah, I think better education is a broad term to support the educational benefits and experience of the kids here. And we want to support that, definitely. And we, as a group, are looking at the decisions and the choices that are being made with this bond proposal and asking, are these really in being made to better the educational experience of the kids here?
So what don't you support? Because you know, those in favor of the bond say that they all benefit the students of the Park City School District.
Well, there's some really good parts to the bond. More emphasis on full-day kindergarten is a good idea. Moving the ninth grade back to high school, great idea. But it just seems like there's too much emphasis on extracurricular activities. I mean, the main reason we're here is to educate the kids. And extracurricular is important. They do contribute to the kids' well-being. But tearing down Dozier with all the expense involved and building a new field house with all the expense involved seems like it's excessive at this point.
So you don't consider dance, music, and athletics legitimate school programs?
Oh, no. Band and the arts and music is a legitimate part of the curriculum. Sports are extracurricular activities. They're an important part. They absolutely are. I coached many teams in my day. I drove my daughter 150 miles round trip to go to soccer practice 3 days a week. So I'm a big supporter of athletics. I just think we have to realize our priorities here.
So you can get behind it except for the $12 million that's been, you know, priced for the athletic facilities?
I'm not willing to be behind it except for the $12 million. To me, there are a lot of questions here. When these presentations started to the community, they were about a bubble of students that were coming through the educational system and how were we going to house those kids. They talked about all-day kindergarten and extended pre-kindergarten and how and where are we going to put those kids. We're not mandated by law to educate those kids, but it seems to be something that has been done and is increasingly done. The questions are, why are we taking space in our elementary schools for those and now having to move our fifth and sixth graders who need to be in school and having to build a whole new building for that? Questions also are, how well is the elementary education setting up the kids for their supposedly new middle school experience, wherever that happens? And are one of the main things that this community, the first community meeting started with was, we want to move the ninth grade into the high school. Okay, well, the request at that time was 16 classrooms to put the ninth grade into the high school. That was what the principal and the request was in the minutes that are on their website. Well, it's expanded into 60,000 square feet of classroom space now, and then another 20,000 square feet for drama and band. Fine, if you want to add stuff for drama and band, that's great, but what's going in this 60,000 square feet? Those answers aren't clear. There have been recommendations made by the superintendent that it's well beyond the programming needs for the ninth graders. And in some of the minutes from October, they said, you know, we can go ahead and start on an addition for the high school without a bond. We don't need a bond. And they said, you know what, let's look at the overarching needs and let's do more. But I keep coming back and saying, why don't we start with what the needs are and look on a longer term basis at what these other at what other things need to be done? To me, that does impact education. You heard it from your administrators yesterday. All of this uncertainty affects everybody. Parents don't know where their kids are going. Administrations don't know how to run their schools. It's a challenge for everybody right now.
Yeah. I wanted to get back to a point that you were making, you know, that we're putting in the full day kindergarten and pre-K and taking kids out. I mean, what studies have shown is that that's actually going to save taxpayers a lot of money in the long run because it's cheaper to educate them when they're young as opposed to having special needs for them as they get older. So, I mean, that's the reason we're doing it. And I mean, and again, that's an educational reason. So why wouldn't you support
that?
You
just don't know. I volunteer in the classrooms at the earliest grade levels, and some of these kids have just not had opportunities to play. They haven't had opportunities to explore being a kid. They've been sitting in classrooms for and programs for most of their youth. And what I see when I go into the classroom is that some of these kids aren't able to sit at a desk and learn. And I start to ask myself, you know, how smart is this to just have our kids be sitting in programs all the time and learning through a classroom thing? You know, could we be more creative in how we're doing things and maybe make a benefit down the line? The second thing that I ask about and have talked with school board members about is there seems to be a lot of concern over the Hispanic population and how well the learning abilities and motivational abilities in schools are for that community. Park City Municipal has most of that population, according to the president of the school board. And so there are questions there of how does the transition of taking them out to Ecker Hill for and busing them an hour a day, what kind of impact does that have on their educational experience overall, and as well as their family and cultural obligations that we may or may not really be taking into account here?
Yeah. And, you know, just to play the devil's advocate, though, I mean, what they're saying is that it's just an issue of fairness. You know, they've got the kids 4 years here within the city limits at the high school with the majority of the population, school population in the Snyderville Basin. It makes sense to have 4 years out there as well.
You know, it's all in how you count your years, right? Most high schoolers can drive for junior and senior year. So whether it's 4 years here, 4 years there, whether it's busing 4 years out and 2 years in, you know, it's all relative. I don't think anybody's opposed to being on a bus. I think some parents would prefer to put their kids on a bus, even to get from Park Meadows to McPolin. I think that there's a petition right now that a mom has out there to try to get the district to relook at their busing policies. The question is, in this community and with the community values and the reasons why people live here, how well does this fit? If you're taking 4 years of schooling out to Ecker Hill, you're taking 4 years of parental trips out there for conferences, for performances, for sports, for doctor visits, for off-schedule sporting events. That's an impact to the traffic in this community that has not been discussed at all. And this plan does create more of that. I think that that needs to be looked at.
Yeah. How many are in your group, Citizens for Better Education? I mean, is it just the two of you, or, I mean, or do you have some support?
No, we have a pretty sizable group. We haven't added up the numbers, but there's a lot of opposition out there, and it's pretty easy to get people involved.
Yeah. So, I mean, are you looking for recruits or?
Absolutely. Anybody that is opposed to the bond for whatever reason, we definitely encourage to voice their opinions and join up and let the community know that this can be done better, that it really needs more time. And we can do a better job next year. And the only real downside is the temporary classrooms, but we have a temporary classroom. It doesn't affect education. Great education goes on in temporary classrooms.
Yeah, but you both are aware, though, that if the bond doesn't pass, the school board will use the money in the capital fund and then just issue, a capital levy, increase the capital levy. So you're going to pay for it one way or another, and it's really a question of, you know, do we pay a lot of money every year or do we try and spread that out over 20 years?
They don't have to do the capital levy. There's
another
option.
But they will. Oh, they say they will.
Well, they say they will. But if they hear loud and clear from their constituents that this is a bad idea, I would hope that they would put it off a year and do it right. And we'll be right there, the first ones to support it if it's done right.
Yeah, everybody wants to support a plan that makes sense for them. That's what we heard at the community forums. And the one at the Park City High School was especially loud and clear with that. You know, does it make sense to wrap a high school campus around an elementary school on Kearns Boulevard? A lot of people were questioning that. We're trying to cut down on student traffic going between the high school and Treasure Mountain where it currently exists. And yet, with the field house there, we've been told that all PE classes will take place there. So there will continue to be quite a bit of traffic between those two schools. And if there's a track up on the North 40, that will extend it even up there. And in the meantime, you've got an elementary in the middle. What's the solution? They're talking about fencing the elementary school. Is that what we want in this town? You know, there really are a lot of things that are being discussed that we're not necessarily getting to engage in that dialogue. You know, another thing that I have a question about is in the bond language specifically. The first thing that it authorizes them to do is to purchase land. And the last thing it authorizes them to do is to pay for all related improvements to this. I don't know what that means. And what land are we buying?
It's boilerplate. I mean, it's part of just the bond language that they got from the state, just like they got the instructions for what can be posted on the website. I kind of need to leave it at that, but if your message resonates with people listening, how can they find you? Do you have a Facebook page?
We do. We have a Facebook page called Citizens for Better Education. They can go on there and post anything that they think is relevant. We'll have some marketing materials that they will be able to access and be in touch with us that way. So Facebook, Citizens for Better Education. We look forward to hearing from people.
Okay, Allie and Jim, thanks for coming in this morning.
Morning News and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is provided by Park City Medical Center, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Deer Valley Resort, and Promontory and the Promontory Foundation.